The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter and probably also from the Harvard Heart Letter. And I'm going to start off with a couple of brief articles from the Harvard Health Letter of April 2025. And the first is entitled, Plant-Based Diets Might Fight Leg or Lung Blood Clots. Eating a plant-based diet, one that's rich in legumes, whole grains, colorful fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, is tied to lower risk for many diseases, like heart disease, diabetes, and some cancers. A large study published in the December 2024 issue of JACC Advances suggests such a diet might also be linked to lower risk of dangerous blood clots in the legs or lungs, even if your genes make you more likely to get them. The research involved 183,000 middle-aged healthy people who were tested for genetic VTE risk and periodically answered questions about their diet. After 13 years, people who were best at sticking to a plant-based diet had a 14% lower risk of developing VTE, compared to those who didn't really follow this eating style. People with a high genetic risk had a 47% higher chance of getting VTE, but those who closely adhered to a plant-based diet still had a lower risk compared to those who didn't eat this way. The study was observational and can't prove that eating a plant-based diet protects people against VTE. But it is plausible. Solid evidence links a plant-based diet to better blood vessel health. Finally, here's another brief article. How much aerobic exercise does it take to lose weight? Exercise is key to maintaining good health, and guidelines recommend at least 150 minutes per week of moderate intensity aerobic exercise, like brisk walking. But how much aerobic exercise does it take to lose weight? One potential answer comes from a review of 116 randomized control trials that included 7,000 people who were overweight or obese. They took part in an exercise program for 8 weeks. Researchers found that participants who did aerobic exercise for as little as 30 minutes per week had some reduction in body weight, waist size, and body fat by the end of the program. The more people exercise, the better the results. An average loss of about 6 pounds and 1.3 inches around the waist for those who exercised 150 minutes per week, and 9 pounds and 1.6 inches for those who exercised 300 minutes per week. The findings were published in the December 2024 issue of JAMA Network Open. Now here's another useful article. It's entitled, Exercises That Go Easy on the Bladder. The high-impact exercise you once loved no longer seems to be a good fit. Now that stress incontinence has crept into your life, maybe you leak urine if you swing your tennis racket with force or do any high-spirited jumping in an aerobics class. The discomfort, hassle, and embarrassment might make you want to give up on your routine. But simple solutions can help keep you in action. Stress incontinence is characterized by the leakage of small amounts of urine when you do anything that puts pressure on the bladder, like coughing, laughing, or exercising. The leaks are the result of weakened pelvic floor muscles. These muscles normally help you hold in urine, bowel movements, and gas. Ideally, the muscles would respond to increased pressure by contracting to prevent leakage. But with stress incontinence, the muscles don't respond properly, says Emily Walsh, a pelvic floor physical therapist at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Weak pelvic floor muscles can result from aging, pregnancy, childbirth, certain surgeries, medication side effects, garbled messages between the muscles and the brain, weak abdominal or hip muscles, or conditions that cause you to strain the pelvic floor muscles like constipation. You need aerobic exercise for good cardiovascular health. Since high-impact aerobic exercise is demanding on pelvic floor muscles, consider low-impact aerobics. For example, instead of playing tennis, play pickleball. Instead of going for a run, go for a brisk walk. Instead of taking Zumba classes, take ballroom dance lessons. Other types of low-impact exercise that won't overload pelvic muscles include swimming, cycling, and seated aerobics, boxing or dancing. If your goal is returning to high-impact activity, consider working with a pelvic floor physical therapist. We can tailor treatment to the symptoms you're having and the activities you want to do, Walsh says. Treatment might include any of the following. The first is Kegel exercises. Your therapist can help you identify your pelvic floor muscles and strengthen them. One way to do this is called a Kegel exercise. All it involves is squeezing like you're trying to stop the flow of urine or hold back gas, holding the contraction for 10 seconds, relaxing, and repeating. Also, there are abdominal and hip exercises. By strengthening abdominal and hip muscles, you also strengthen the pelvic floor, since there's overlap among the muscles, Walsh says. Examples include bridges, planks, and clamshells. A clamshell means lying on your side with your knees bent and raising and lowering only your top knee while keeping your feet together. Then there are breathing exercises. A lot of people hold their breath while exercising, but that puts increased pressure on pelvic floor muscles and weakens them, Walsh says. A helpful clue is exhaling with exertion. Breathe out at the hardest part of the exercise, which will give you more intense contractions of the abdominal and pelvic floor muscles. Also, you should practice some other strategies. You should prepare for leaks. Wear absorbent bladder leak underwear or an absorbent pad. You'll stay comfortable and be able to keep exercising. Empty your bladder just before exercising. That's easy to do at home. If you're exercising elsewhere, it helps to locate bathrooms in advance. Also, squeeze during exertion. Walsh suggests doing a Kegel-style contraction as you exert yourself with force, as you swing a racket, for example. Stay hydrated throughout the day. You might be inclined to avoid drinking a lot of fluids, hoping to reduce urine leaks, but that can lead to dehydration, which can cause confusion, fatigue, and falls, problems you always want to avoid, especially during exercise. Finally, talk to your doctor. If you continue to leak during exercise, consult your doctor about other incontinence treatments, like medication or surgery. Now let's turn to the Harvard Heart Letter. This is the Harvard Heart Letter of April 2025. And the first of useful article in the Harvard Heart Letter is entitled Varicose Veins, More Than a Cosmetic Concern. Gnarled purple-blue leg veins that bulge beneath the skin surface raise the risk of blood clots and related complications. Your leg veins face a constant uphill battle, working against gravity to transport blood from your feet back up to your heart. But sometimes the one-way valves inside them weaken, allowing blood to trickle backward and pool inside the veins. Over time, the veins just under the surface of the skin can become engorged and twisted, bulging visibly. Known as varicose veins, this common problem is unsightly and often uncomfortable, causing symptoms like pain, aching, and a feeling of heaviness in the legs. And for some people, varicose veins are a harbinger of more serious problems. One complication is a blood clot inside a varicose vein called superficial vein thrombosis. Causes include dehydration and injury. A small section of the vein turns hard, red, and painful, says Dr. Sherry Scovell, a vascular surgeon who specializes in venous disease at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. If that happens, go to the emergency room for an ultrasound, she advises. The superficial veins connect to larger veins deep inside the leg, which means a small clot can move to a deep vein and grow. About 25% of people with superficial vein thrombosis also have deep vein thrombosis, says Dr. Scovell. Deep vein thrombosis poses a serious threat if the blood clot breaks off and travels to a blood vessel serving the lung, causing a potentially life-threatening blockage called pulmonary embolism. We used to treat superficial vein clots with small doses of ibuprofen and a warm compress. Now doctors prescribe an anti-clotting drug like Eliquis or Xarelto for 45 days to help prevent DVT. Treating varicose veins can help reduce this risk. Left untreated, varicose veins can also cause other complications. Blood can leak from damaged valves and pool in the ankles, causing swelling and skin changes. As the problem advances, the damaged layer of the skin breaks down to the point where even a tiny nick or scratch can result in an oozing open wound that's prone to infection. Varicose veins run in families and become more common with age. They're also more prevalent among women, in part because of the increase in blood volume that occurs during pregnancy. Being overweight also raises your risk. Three simple strategies can help. First, you should get moving. Exercise that works your calf muscles, like walking, helps. So do calf raises. Point and flex your feet if you have to sit for long periods of time. Put your feet up. Give your legs a break by elevating your feet at the end of the day, and even during the middle of the day if possible. This can relieve pressure on the veins to help keep them healthy. And put on compression stockings. Those snug elastic stockings are tighter at the ankle than the calf, squeezing your legs slightly to help keep blood moving. People also need to wear compression stockings for at least 2 weeks after a vein ablation treatment. Many people are initially reluctant, but then end up wearing them even longer, because the stockings make their legs feel great. These aren't the thick beige stockings your grandmother wore. They come in different colors, patterns, and compression levels. Dr. Scovell, who wears thigh-high black compression stockings that resemble tights every day at work, you can find them online or in drugstores. But if you have a serious vein-related complication, a medical supply store may be your best option for finding the most appropriate product. The article goes on to mention that there are treatments to eliminate varicose veins. The oldest and best studied is thermal ablation. A doctor threads a narrow tube called a catheter into the faulty vein, then applies heat in the form of laser or radio frequency energy to collapse the vein and seal it shut. Then there's chemical ablation, which uses a foam solution that causes the vein's interior walls to scar and close. There is adhesive closure, which delivers a natural glue that pulls the vein walls together. And there's mechanochemical ablation, which uses a rotating wire to damage the vein, along with medication to encourage scar tissue to close the vein. Again, here's another useful article from the Harvard Heart Letter, and it's entitled, The Cancer-Heart Disease Connection. Cancer survivors face a heightened risk of heart disease. The reverse, more cancer among people with heart disease, may also be true. Thanks to advances in cancer detection and therapy, people with cancer are living far longer than in years past. Nearly 20 million people in the United States, about 6% of the population, are cancer survivors. Despite what you might assume, These people are actually more likely to die of heart disease than from cancer-related complications, says Dr. Anju Noria, director of the cardio-oncology program at Harvard-affiliated Dana-Farber Brigham Cancer Center. One reason is that certain cancer treatments can cause cardiovascular complications, but the two diseases share many root causes. For example, tobacco use is widely known to raise the risk of both heart disease and cancer, and some experts believe obesity may soon surpass cigarette smoking as the number one preventable cause of cancer. Other health issues linked to heart disease, diabetes, high cholesterol, and high blood pressure are also associated with cancer, as described in a review titled Cardiovascular Disease and Cancer, a Dangerous Liaison, in the March 2025 issue of Arteriosclerosis, Thrombosis, and Vascular Biology. In people with diabetes, high blood sugar damages blood vessels and nerves that control your heart, increasing the risk of heart attack, stroke, and other cardiovascular problems. The resulting inflammation can also create an environment that favors tumor growth, and elevated blood sugar levels may help fuel the growth of malignant cells. Likewise, excess blood cholesterol, a key component of artery clogging plaque, may also hasten growth of cancer cells. High blood pressure's role in heart disease is clear. The relentless pounding of the blood against the artery walls also promotes plaque formation, and the resulting narrowing of the arteries only worsens the problem. The observed connection between high blood pressure and cancer isn't as well understood, but it may arise from alterations in blood flow, increased inflammation, and other factors. Finally, people who've had a heart attack or heart failure appear to develop cancer more frequently than the general population. If you have cancer or heart disease, ask your doctor whether your planned treatment might lead to cardiovascular problems. This is especially important for people age 65 and older, and anyone with risk factors for heart disease, like high blood pressure or diabetes, who may want to request referral to a cardio-oncologist. When we see people who are undergoing treatment for cancer, we try to identify and modify their risk factors for heart disease as much as possible, says Dr. Noria. Many cancer survivors get CT scans as part of their treatment and surveillance. If these scans reveal calcium deposits in their coronary arteries, they may benefit from cholesterol-lowering drugs to limit their risk of heart attack. Likewise, people with heart disease should be sure to follow cancer screening guidelines from the American Cancer Society. People with serious health conditions sometimes adopt a fatalistic view and abandon healthy lifestyle efforts, says Dr. Noria. Others view their diagnosis and recovery as a new lease on life and do everything they can to stay healthy, an approach that she actively supports. Now here's a useful short segment entitled Ask the Doctor, by Dr. Christopher Cannon, who's the editor-in-chief. And the question is, do I need to fast before my cholesterol test? The answer is, for most people, no. Here's the backstory. For decades, we've told people not to eat or drink for 8 to 12 hours before a cholesterol test. This was based on the thought that a measurement done after fasting would provide a more accurate assessment of all the lipids in the blood, including LDL cholesterol and triglycerides. However, studies show that the difference between fasting and non-fasting values for cholesterol are usually negligible. An analysis using data from a clinical trial of 4,100 people compared the results from lipid tests done with and without fasting. The LDL or bad cholesterol values were only about 4 milligrams per deciliter higher when people weren't fasting. Because the cholesterol guidelines focus on LDL, whether you are fasting won't matter for determining whether your LDL is at goal. So if people come to my clinic and they've had breakfast or lunch we go ahead and take a blood sample. But triglycerides are another story. After you eat, your body immediately converts any excess calories from food into triglycerides, which are then stored in fat cells. In addition, any saturated fat you eat is broken down into smaller fatty particles called chylomicrons, which enter the bloodstream and further contribute to a temporary rise in triglycerides. Some people have high triglyceride levels, which is more common among those who are overweight or have diabetes or prediabetes. For these people, not fasting can often lead to very high triglyceride levels. So anyone who has ever had a high triglyceride level should always fast before a lipid test. This will provide a more accurate assessment of their triglyceride level, which is then used to inform treatment recommendations. If a person's triglycerides are higher than 150 on a fasting lipid test, that is linked to a higher risk of heart attack or related cardiovascular issues. Treatment starts with diet and exercise, but may include medications, although the latter are usually reserved for people who have heart disease or are at high risk for it, including those with diabetes. When I see a new patient, I look back at their earlier lipid test results. If most of their triglycerides are within the normal range, I tell them they don't need to fast before their blood test. But if some of their values are high, I ask them to fast. Because fasting can be challenging if you can't schedule a morning blood test, ask your doctor if not fasting is an option for you. Now let's turn to some shorter articles. And the first one is, cigar, pipe, and smokeless tobacco use is linked to distinct heart risks. Using tobacco in cigars, pipes, or smokeless products like snuff is associated with distinct heart-related risks. For the study, researchers pooled data from 15 studies from 1948 to 2015 that included data about the use of at least one tobacco product. Among the more than 103,000 participants included the study about 1% smoked tobacco in pipes, 2% smoke cigars, and 2% use smokeless tobacco. After a median follow-up of 14 years, researchers found that current cigar use was linked to an increased risk of stroke, atrial fibrillation, and heart failure, while current pipe use was associated with a higher risk of heart failure. Smokeless tobacco users faced a heightened risk of heart attack and death due to heart disease. The study was published in JAMA Network Open. Then here again is another brief article. New online tool ranks processed foods. Diets high in ultra-processed foods are linked to an increased risk of heart disease. But which foods are the true culprits? A free online database called True Food, www.truefood.tech, can now help people make more informed choices about processed foods. Developed by researchers at Harvard Medical School, the database provides nutrition facts and ingredient information on 50,000 processed foods. Ultra-processed foods often contain high amounts of sugar, salt, and unhealthy fats, as well as additives and preservatives. Products are divided into 42 separate categories, like crackers and mixed snacks, yogurts, prepared meals and dishes, and soft, energy, and mixed drinks. Each product is given a single score, ranking from 0, meaning minimally processed, to 100, highly processed, compared to all the other foods within a specific category. The website also provides food substitution recommendations aimed at gently nudging consumers toward less processed alternatives, according to the scientists who published their research in the January issue of Nature Food. And intensive blood pressure control may lower the risk of cognitive problems. For people at high risk for heart disease, aggressive blood pressure control may lower their future risk of cognitive impairment, according to the February issue of Neurology. The study included 7,221 people aged 50 and older who were part of an earlier, larger trial of participants who were randomly assigned to receive either standard or intensive blood pressure treatment, a systolic blood pressure goal of less than 140 or less than 120, respectively. The trial was stopped early after 3.3 years because of the clear benefit of intensive treatment for reducing heart disease. To evaluate the cognitive effects, researchers then followed the participants for a median of 7 years using telephone-based cognitive assessments to classify them into three groups: no impairment, mild impairment, or probable dementia. People in the intensive treatment group had a lower combined rate of cognitive impairment or probable dementia than those in the standard treatment group. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.